Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, RFURL's Monday podcast about significant developments and upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Steve Gutterman, and for those of you who may have just joined us, my guest is Irina Lagunina, Associate Standards Editor and former Director and Special Projects Editor of the Russian Service here at RFURL. Irina's been an excellent guest on this podcast in the past, and I'm very glad she could join us again today. Welcome, Irina.
It's always my pleasure, Steve.
All right. It's great to have you on the podcast. Now, last week, the war in Ukraine passed the 100-day mark, 100 days since the large-scale Russian invasion on February 24th. It's still kind of unfathomable to me, at least, this unjustified death and destruction that Russian President Vladimir Putin has unleashed. But at the same time, it is obviously a very real, and there's really no end in sight, at least in the short to medium term, as I see it. In recent days and weeks, there's been very heavy fighting in the Donbass, that's Ukraine's Donetsk and Luhansk regions, where the war has in fact been going on for more than 8 years, since April 2014, when Russia fomented separatism there and in other parts of Ukraine, after a Moscow-friendly president who had turned away from Europe was pushed from power, essentially, in Kiev by the Maidan protest movement. Members of that movement were protesting in favor of closer relations with Europe and against corruption and other problems. Now, specifically, in recent days and weeks, there's been fierce fighting in the town of Severodonetsk, that's in the Luhansk region, where Russian gains last week seemed to be part of a general trend of Russian forces slowly advancing in the Donbass. But over the weekend, it appeared that Ukrainian forces launched a counteroffensive and took back some of the territory they had lost. And now today, there are indications that the pendulum may have swung back again. So it's a very fluid, very fast moving and very deadly situation there. Now, this heavy fighting in the Donbass comes after some very major setbacks for Russia in the first weeks and the first couple months of the war. It seems clear that Putin had believed at the beginning that Ukraine would be subjugated essentially within days. But obviously that did not happen. Irina, of course, it's impossible to know what Putin is thinking, but I wonder if you have a sense of this. Does Putin, do you think he believes that Russia is winning this war? And what might he see as a victory? What is the Kremlin's goal at this point?
Steve, I don't think that the Kremlin's goal ever changed since the beginning of the war. It was obvious from the very beginning that Donbass area, mainly Donetsk and Luhansk regions, is not the kind of final goal of this war. The final goal is Kiev, of course. And Vladimir Putin, when he, in two speeches that he gave before the start of the war and the speech that he gave on the eve of the invasion, he actually very clearly stated that he denies Ukraine the very right to exist. So for him, this goal that he set starting this aggression was to eliminate Ukraine as a state, as a precedent, and what we see in Ukraine right now as a cultural entity, because so many objects of culture and libraries and textbooks are being destroyed, burnt, and in the areas that Russia that are under Russian occupation right now, they immediately changed the school program to Russian standards, and there is no Ukrainian language anymore. There is no Ukrainian history in schools. So this is the final goal, as Putin sees it, and as he shared it publicly. Now, whether Putin now sees this as a successful military campaign or not remains to be seen. You know, with Kremlin, as if I may use the famous quote, as there are known unknowns and there are unknown unknowns. So known unknowns is that we don't know whether Putin is given the true picture of how the military campaign is developing in Ukraine, and how we don't know how he interprets it. It's interesting that, for example, Levada Center, one of the few, actually the only one remaining independent polis in Russia that is left right now, they are asking for 2 months right now. If Russians see the operation in Ukraine as successful or not. So in April, 68% of Russians replied that it was successful and 17% that it was not. In May, though, and this results were just published recently, 73% of Russians thought that the operation is so-called military operations, special military operations, because Russians are not allowed to say the word war. So 73% of Russians said that the special military operation in Ukraine is successful, and 15% said not. So this is up 5%. Whereas we see the heavy fighting and we see the setbacks for Russian troops in various parts of Ukraine, so it's a very interesting study. And if you, Steve, permit, I will go on with this study, because with this poll, because I think it's very interesting.
Yes, of course.
The other question that Levada Center asked was who will win this war? And in April, 73% of respondents in Russia said that it will be Russia. Only 1% that it is Ukraine. 15% that nobody will win, and 11% didn't know how to answer. In May, though, 75% said that Russia will win, 1% that Ukraine will win, 15% that nobody, and 9% don't know how to answer. So this is a very interesting study. Russians are, first of all, they think that the operation is successful, and secondly, they are sure that Russia will win this war. Which is one of the scenarios, of course, because, you know, I don't think that this setback in attack on Kyiv actually changed what the end goal of the Russian war in Ukraine is. Russia is prepared and is showing that it is prepared for a long conflict. Actually, majority of Russians, 44%, judging from this same poll, say that they are prepared that the war will last up to a year or even longer. So Russia is prepared for a long military campaign. And let me remind you that over the weekend, Kyiv was once again under attack by Russian missiles. For Russian missiles landed in the capital, and Putin showed, I mean, he said frankly and straightforward that if West supplies Ukraine with heavy arms and armament, then the next targets will be the next targets will be the targets that Russia didn't touch yet, meaning that it's going to be probably the Rada, the parliament of Ukraine, and the government offices and presidential offices. Steve?
Yes. Thank you for that. I guess I would just mention some fascinating points. I would mention, you know, I think polls obviously, you know, can be skewed to some degree, but I guess one main takeaway I would have from the Levada polls that you mentioned is that probably the capability of Putin to claim a victory kind of at any point or almost any point is fairly high. He can frame things as a victory. I guess that wouldn't be possible if Russian forces are pushed out of Ukraine. But it seems like the capacity for Putin to kind of tell Russians that we've done what we sought to achieve is pretty high, especially since part of what Putin and other officials have been saying is that the idea is to protect the Donbass and people in the Donbass. Of course, they are actually killing and destroying the Donbass, but that's another issue.
I to interrupt you, but it's amazing how susceptible people are to the state propaganda, because one of the questions was who is to blame, and 8% said nobody, 7% said Russia is to blame in this military conflict. 17%, amazing, right? Very low. 17% of Russians said that it's Ukraine to be blamed. And 57% said that it's the United States and the West who are to blame. And that's exactly the propaganda narrative in Russia, that it's the West who actually tried to use Ukraine to destroy Russia and its values, and who supported so-called Ukrainian Nazis. Interesting fact, they don't use this word anymore. Even RIA Novosti stopped using it, and they now say Ukraine military forces, which is a very interesting change in Russian rhetoric. But nonetheless, it was the West who actually, through Ukraine, posed a threat to Russia. And people are reacting and accepting this.
Right. You're absolutely right. And I think more and more lately, Russian officials have been framing it as, we are fighting against, essentially defending against an effort, as you said, by the West and NATO, to essentially destroy Russia or subjugate Russia. So it's kind of a reversal of what's actually going on. But you're absolutely right. I think that's shown in the polls that people are to some extent believing this propaganda about the war being an effort to defend against the West rather than Ukraine itself. Of course, the claims about Ukraine, one of the things that Russia has been saying, Lavrov and others have been saying since the invasion was, well, we had to do it because Ukraine was about to invade. First they said the Donbass, then they said essentially invade Russia. So that's another part of the narrative. One other thing I'd just like to point out expand on from what you said, there's been a lot of attention now on the Donbass, of course, because of the fighting there. But you also mentioned the efforts Russia is making to essentially erase Ukrainian culture and the Ukrainian presence in parts of Ukraine that it currently controls, and this includes areas in the south, southwest of the Donbass. So that's another thing that's happening, and I believe Russia now controls about 20% of Ukrainian territory, including Crimea. So, that's something that is quite astounding, and it's just something that Russia is also pursuing. And as you said, this goes back to Putin's repeated claims both before and after the invasion of February 24th. That Ukraine essentially has no right to exist as a fully sovereign or sovereign state. But now I'd like to also go back to another thing you mentioned, which is kind of the polls about what people think about whether the war is a success and what Putin thinks about that. And it's kind of, I like to ask about the critics of the war in Russia. You know, a lot of people amid a huge kind of relentless clampdown that got worse and worse in the year before the invasion, and then even worse after it. Many Russians who did protest or may have been inclined to protest against the war, you know, have left, essentially driven out of the country. And opposition leader Alexei Navalny, of course, has had his prison sentence extended to 9 years. And now we learned last week that he faces charges that could result in a 15-year sentence. And protests against the war in Ukraine in Russia now tend to be very small, in many cases just one person essentially showing courage by protesting. But I want to ask about the threat to Putin that may be posed by a very different group of people, essentially nationalists or hardliners who are by no means opposed to Russia's war on Ukraine, but are angry or dissatisfied by the way it is being done, by the high casualty toll among Russian forces and the setbacks that the military has faced. You know, these are people who are saying that you know Russia could be being much more successful on the battlefield. Irina, do you think that these people, these voices, I guess, pose a threat to Putin? And how might they affect the way Russia pursues this war in the coming days and months? I've heard analysts say, you know, Putin fears this group of people more than he fears kind of the liberal opponents of the war.
Well, I, you know, frankly, Steve, looking at what at the crackdown on civil society and each and every protest of even single people who just one protester that goes out in the middle of the city is grabbed by police within 15, 20 minutes, sometimes even faster. So this is a total crackdown, and there is a certain fear, apparently, on behalf of the authorities, on the part of the authorities towards any sort of protest. Regarding the people who, those people who, and we don't know if they exist, by the way, there are rumors, there are reports that are based on sources, but we didn't see, and I want to stress it, we didn't see a single public outcry against the war or against the way the war is conducted from Kremlin officials or from the circle surrounding Putin. We saw three oligarchs that were kind of horrified with the war, and they all left Russia. But from within this hawkish community around Putin, there was no public criticism yet. So we can only base our assessment on the reports based on sources. On the other hand, the person who is the most hawkish in Putin's circle, and this is the chairman of the Security Council of Russia, whose name is Nikolai Patrushev, seems to be quite in line with what Putin is doing, and actually continues to publish articles and give interview as he was doing it before the war. And recently he once again spoke about the way the so-called special military operation unfolding, and repeated once again his statement that Poland actually wants to conquer part of the territory of Ukraine. And as a proof of this, he gave the visit of Polish president to Kiev recently. This is something that goes in parallel with the Kremlin narrative that they want to destroy Ukraine as a state, So this idea of Patrushev kind of unfolds quite a time already of to separate Ukraine between like Poland and Russia, and then probably to fight with Poland trying to liberate the part of Ukraine that was occupied by Poland. I mean, you can question the normality of such statements and claims, the sanity of such allegations. But this is something that exists in Putin's circle, in their mind, and I think that this kind of this attitude of through Ukraine we are fighting with the West is actually manifesting in such claims as well. Whether that will represent a threat to Putin or whether it does represent a threat to Putin, it's really difficult to say. But at the moment, it looks like the hawkish group around Putin is still quite pleased with how the situation is unfolding and how the conflict is going on. And they really think that they will win this war, maybe not in 3 days as they planned, but in a year.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there certainly doesn't seem to be any visible cracks, at the highest levels around Putin. You mentioned Patrushev and he seems to be becoming. I mean, he was once pretty much silent, didn't speak publicly lately. Before and even more so after the new invasion in February, I think he's spoken out a lot more. I believe he's had three articles published since the invasion, and certainly, his goals and his kind of claims seem in line with Putin. I've always wondered, how much influence does this person who has been with Putin, for decades throughout his rise to power and his being in power, how much influence does he have? Who's kind of driving whom? And I think Mark Galeotti called him the most dangerous man in Russia. I may be misquoting that slightly, but certainly his opinions or his the articles, the propaganda that he's been putting out, kind of don't bode well for. I mean, I guess they kind of reinforce the idea that Russia is ready to continue fighting this war and sees it, to some degree as kind of a standoff with the West. Whether the sort of reality of what's happening on the battlefield will kind of catch up with that, I guess, is something that remains to be seen. Okay, I would like to, we're running a little bit short on time. If there are, and I'd like to take some questions, if there are any. Again, you can raise your hand by requesting a speaker privilege, or you can send a direct message or reply to the tweet in the Twitter spaces if you want to ask a question. So I'll just give it a few more moments. Okay. One question has come in at least. Sorry, from Luca Grandicelli. Apologies if I'm mispronouncing that. According to public opinion in Russia, how much of this war is attributed to the geopolitical issues of the Ukrainian separatist regions, and how much instead is attributed to a more general question of the balance of relations between Russia and NATO. So I guess, Irina, could you comment on that? I guess it's sort of a question of, you know, to what degree people are seeing this in Russia, are seeing this as an issue of the Donbass, or and to what degree they're seeing it as kind of a standoff between Russia and NATO.
Well, actually, this poll already answered this question, who is to blame for the war, and 57% said the United States and the West. But having said that, the general, of course, Russians see it as, more and more with the sanctions starting to affect the Russian economy. And sanctions, of course, come from the West, not from Ukraine. So more and more Russians are inclined to blame in this conflict the West and the United States. But at the same time, from the very beginning, the state propaganda was using the pretext that for 8 years Ukrainians were allegedly shelling and bombing the Donbas Separatist Republic, Donetsk Separatist Republic, and Lugansk Separatist Republic. And that was the kind of common saying, that where have you been for those 8 years while Ukrainians were, killing our citizens in those two republics. So the narrative at the beginning was it's because of Ukrainian behavior around so-called Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republic. Mm-hmm. But now it's changing. It's changing dramatically, and it's like everywhere. This almost anecdote almost a joke that the Russian foreign minister couldn't travel to Serbia. Visit was supposed to be on the 6th and the 7th, but the neighboring Balkan countries actually didn't allow him the passage through their airspace. So he had to cancel this visit to Serbia. And today, the head of Russian space agency, Dmitry Rogozin, wrote in his Twitter that, it's good that Russian missiles do not ask permission to fly through the airspace and unleashed on Romania, Bulgaria, and Macedonia, North Macedonia, for closing the, and Montenegro actually for closing the airspace. So it's everywhere. It's West, right, is the monster.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just point out, sort of in a similar vein, I think there was reports, there have been reports about school children in Russia singing a song, having to sing a song about, basically Putin, if you order us to the final battle, we're ready, we're with you. That's obviously not about the Donbass. It's a way of the government framing this as a civilizational conflict against the West. So I think that, that propaganda is coming to the fore more and more. Another question from a reply to the pinned tweet. Thank you. It's about Belarus. The question is, Belarus's Alexander Lukashenko is ordering each town to arm and begin to train 50 citizens per town as a, quote, civil defense of sorts. And also there's been a large buildup of artillery on the southwestern border of Belarus near Ukraine. Do we worry that Belarus may be readying to fight Ukraine? That's the question, Irina.
Yes, we always worry about it because, Lukashenko have been able to maneuver starting from the 2014 when Russia annexed Crimea, Lukashenko never recognized the so-called independent Donbas republics. He was maneuvering around, recognition of annexation of Crimea. But to what extent he will be able to maneuver now remains to be seen, because right now the unprecedented sanctions are imposed not only against Russia, but against Belarus. These sanctions are not only the result of the war, but also the result of the behavior of Lukashenko himself and the hijacking of an airplane. So this is a difficult situation for Belarus. It's economically much weaker than Russia, and it is right now dependent on Russia, for example, in trying to sell fertilizers, because Belarus is a huge producer of fertilizers, and those are banned right now. So Russia has its own fertilizer production. So it's not really interested in Belarus fertilizers, but it's a dire situation for Minsk. So whether the situation will lead Minsk to accept and obey to Russian, pressure to participate in the war, we don't know it, but it might be the case. It definitely might be the case.
Yeah, I mean, things have changed a lot in Belarus over the last few years. And of course, it is a big question, a very important question, whether Belarus will get involved beyond, housing Russian troops that then invaded. I just would point out that in the past, in the 90s and 2000s, kind of Lukashenko's biggest, one of the main reasons for his popularity in Belarus was, he could say, there's no war. Our boys are not at war. This was during the war in Chechnya. And other conflicts. So, things are changing. We'll see what happens there. And now there's a question from Martin. Martin, please go ahead.
Thank you very much. I appreciate this. A couple points I wanted to raise and you could respond to. One is, so what are the Russians saying when they see that, thousands and thousands of their sons either aren't coming home or are coming home in body bags or some other means of transport for dead soldiers? The estimates of number of Russians killed during this war, and let's call it what it is, a war being waged against a non-threatening democratic country. So what is the population saying about that? Estimates are up to 30,000 Russian soldiers have been killed. And secondly, and I mentioned this on another forum yesterday, the newspaper USA Today, Ben Ferenc, 102 years old, the last living judge from the Nuremberg trials, called for a tribunal to be set up to try, in his words, Putin and his thugs for war crimes. Personally, I think that's a great idea. So I'd like you to comment on that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I'll ask Irina to respond shortly. I just wanted to mention on the issue of the Russian losses and what Russians think when they see this. For one thing, not all of them are seeing it, I believe. There are people in places in Russia where a lot of soldiers have been sent, from which a lot of soldiers have been sent, and many of them coming back, as you say, in body bags. So people there are aware to some degree. But elsewhere, I think people may not be. the Russian, essentially the last time the Russian military, believe, you know, gave an official casualty figure was in March, and that figure was 1,500 or so. I think less than 1,500 Russian soldiers killed. You know, obviously, as you mentioned, estimates are as high. I think the Ukrainian estimate is around 30,000, and U.S. and others, including intelligence agencies, you know, have said 15 or more, which as you mentioned, Martin, is more than the number killed in Afghanistan, the number of Soviet soldiers killed in the Afghan War, which lasted for almost a decade. So, you know, I think to some degree these things are being hidden, you know, and they're not, Russians are generally not seeing the same news stories, same information that we are seeing in the West. But Irina, do you have any other comments on that?
Yeah, it's true that Russians do not see this, and there are really different estimates of the number of Russian casualties. Some say that between 2,000 and 3,000. BBC, I think, over 2,000 names that they know, they collected. The problem is that there are actually several regions of Russia where there are where the troops were sent to Ukraine from, and there the number of casualties, of course, is higher, and there it's known, like Buryatia or Dagestan, in Tatarstan, Ulyanovsk area, there are quite a lot of people dead there. But it's not, even, you know, even those people who, those families who lost their sons, accept and see it completely in a different way. It's not that their sons were sent to, you know, to fight against a neighboring state, to eliminate this state from the earth. They were sent there to defend Russia from Nazism and from the West. So they are returning back in, you know, in the coffins, but they are returning as heroes. And the propaganda, even on local area, does everything to glorify those who were killed. They name schools after them. Practically in those areas with a large number of casualties, they now have a alley of memorial of the glory of those who gave their lives in Ukraine. So to some extent, it's, you know, it's a very glorifying thing to lose a child or a relative or a son or you know, a brother in this war. We interviewed several of the relatives, mothers of those who were killed in Ukraine, and it's just amazing that they have no regret that their son was sent to fight in Ukraine. No regret at all.
Sorry to interrupt. That is such a, if I may say, a condemnation of the society that Russia is right now under this dictatorship, that they would believe such nonsense. It really is... It's almost depraved, I would say. They are acting like the Nazis, like fascists, you know. It's anyways. Could you comment as well upon my other comment about Ben Ferez?
Yeah, I'll just speak on that for a second, and then Irina can as well. On the war crimes, I mean, Ukraine has started trying Russian soldiers on war crimes charges, so that's happening. And then international groups are gathering evidence along with Ukrainian authorities. But I think actually, I'll kind of link the two questions and say that you know, what will ultimately happen in terms of Russian citizens seeing the effects of the war and seeing what's really going on, and what will happen in terms of war crimes, prosecutions and trials, and how high they might go is pretty hard to predict right now, at least in my view. It's sort of the war is still raging, and these things will depend on the further course of the war. It sounds kind of cold to say, but also on the outcome. Irina?
Yeah, I just can add that actually the first step towards creating the sort of international tribunal, and this is the only mechanism that can be applied in this particular case if the international community decides to do so in future, because the International Criminal Court in The Hague, Russia is not a part of. Plus, Russia is the permanent member of the Security Council, so this path is closed as well. But the first step is made, and that's the international investigation under the UN umbrella of what was done by Russian troops in Ukraine, and not only by Russian, but on all sides, but well, it turns out to be, of course, much more Russian troops.
Okay, thanks very much, Irina, and thank you for the questions and for listening. Let's wrap it up there. We're really running out of time. Irina, thanks. Thanks for your insights, and thanks very much for joining me again.
Thank you for inviting, Steve.
Okay, once again, I've been speaking to Irina Lagunina, Associate Standards Editor and former Director and Special Projects Editor of the Russian Service here at RFERL. And my name is Steve Gutterman, Editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL. As I mentioned at the start, the conversation will also be published as a podcast, and you can subscribe to The Week Ahead in Russia and other RFERL podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts. I will be back next Monday for another edition of The Week Ahead in Russia. And please keep an eye out for my newsletter, The Week in Russia, Friday. Thanks for listening.